Hello everyone, happy Tuesday. This is Jeff Nee from the Museum Alliance, and it's our pleasure to welcome you to this telecon today. Thank you to all of you for joining us and to anyone listening to the recording in the future. Today we're hearing about the anatomy of the Blue Dragon lava flows. The slides for today's presentation can be found on the Museum Alliance and Solar System Ambassador sites. As always, if you have any issues or questions now or in the future, please email me at jnee@jpl.nasa.gov. Our speaker today is Dr. Alex Selke, a postdoctoral research fellow at the NASA Ames Research Center. He started studying geosciences at the Leibniz University of Hanover, Germany, and he got his PhD at the University of Missouri, Columbia. He studied lava flows and surface morphologies around the world, including Hawaii, Guatemala, and Costa Rica, and he's working as part of NASA's field investigations to enable solar system sciences, also known as SENES. He's also part of the Biologic Analog Science Associated with Lava Terrains, or BASALT. NASA does love its acronyms. His full biography can be found on the websites, and without further ado, Alex, take it away.
Well, thank you so much for the introduction, and thanks for having me today. It's a great pleasure to introduce all the results I've done for the project of FINESS. And in the next 45 minutes, the talk focuses really on the FINESS goals, which is science enabling exploration and vice versa. And the science that I'm presenting here is understanding the changes in lava flows, especially the physical properties of the lava and how they correlate to surface morphology. And then the exploration, how this relationship actually can be used to infer these properties by looking at the lava flow morphologies through remote sensing techniques, enabling us a better understanding of the landscape and its volcanic history before we actually go there, such as the moon or other planetary objects. Let's just skip to slide number two, and I'm giving in the next couple of slides a quick rundown on just some of the most prominent lava flow features that we have across the solar system. I keep it really broad. The second slide is just lava flows on the moon. They're really long. There are a lot of them, especially in the Mara regions. They can be even really specific, such as lunar rills, which are kind of like deep excavated lava flows into the ground. If we go to slide number two, we see a couple more features on the larger map. There's a lot of red dots. Those are actually, it's a recent study that just came out, mapping out really recent lava flows up to 10 million years, which are kind of lava flow blobs coming out of the surface of the moon. Slide number four, skip to Venus, and we have a variety of landforms there too. We have these pancake-shaped lava domes, and then we have large extensive lava flow fields as well, as we can see on the right side, which is emanating from an impact crater site, most likely. If we skip to slide number five, we have lava flows on Mars. Again, the scale is huge. If you're looking at the map that's kind of rotated on the left, we have a little 200-kilometer scale on the left bottom. And those are large lava flows that extend hundreds of kilometers. And they're mostly in the Tartus region where we have a lot of volcanoes. There's a kind of false image color off the basaltic rocks that we have identified on the surface on the bottom right corner. Next slide, number six, still on Mars, and there we have a large lava flow field that's coming in from the north on the right side of the image on the bottom, which kind of looks rough, and then it stops somewhere where we see on the left kind of linear features, some kind of a channel or something, but we can clearly see a lava flow margin, and it doesn't really look, at least in my eyes, doesn't really look smooth there at all. It kind of see all kinds of features on the surface. If we go on slide number seven, still on Mars, I always have to mention the largest volcano we have in the solar system on the Mons, just as big as the entire state of Arizona. If we skip over to slide number eight, we have Mercury, and we see the same thing, huge lava flows. Entire northern hemisphere of Mercury is actually one coherent lava field that's called the Northern Volcanic Plains. And if you superimpose that to the continental U.S., it's almost as large as that. So it's huge. And we have a variety of lava flow features, different morphologies in channels. They're coming in from one side in that frame C, which is coming in from the left side of that image and then just abruptly stopping. If we go to the right panel, see picture D, we actually can see those lava flows filling up impact craters. And right below that, there's lava flows that are coming from both sides. So there's lots of lava just flowing onto the surface. And then on the bottom, G, you actually can see that old ancient craters are totally buried. You can just see kind of the outlines by those lava flows. So there's lots of volcanic material on the surface that has been just running down the hills. If we go on to slide number 10, as an example, there's maybe even lava flows on the surface of asteroids or larger ones. And here that is an image of asteroid Vesta. There's lots of question marks, so it's still debated if there's really lava flow features, but for sure there are signs that this is all magmatic history in the rocks itself, as we have some samples that are asteroid samples that have landed on Earth that we attribute to the coming from the surface of Vesta. And then I think it's the last one. If you go to Io, which is the moon of Jupiter, it's constantly erupting. It is the most volcanic active body in the solar system. And we see the same feature in here. We have a nice global mosaic on the left. If we look in one frame in the middle, we can actually see a huge lava flow as well, changing its shape, starting on the bottom center, kind of dark and kind of slim, and then it widens as it goes further up in that image. And if we zoom in a little bit more, you can see the edges changes, even the colors change on the surface and might reflect some different types of morphologies in here. And the next slide is actually just a copy and paste error by me. So we have talked about this already, so we can just skip over in here. So we are now on number slide 13, and this is where the hypothesis comes in here. So I've seen a lot of basaltic lava flows. So basalts are covering the entire solar system where we have volcanic activity. So it's useful, first of all, to study that kind of material on Earth to understand it better. So, but what I hypothesized in my project is that the lava flow morphology corresponds to specific values in physical properties of the lava. And such properties would be crystallinity, fissicularity, so how much bubbles and crystals are in the lava, the density that's associated with it, and the eruption temperature. And nicely, these all have an impact on the viscosity of the lava. So once we can understand this entire relationship, which is kind of pictured in that little diagram on the right bottom side, which says lava flow morphology, so we can actually go backwards in that, because lava flow morphology is what we can see, and I know and we know that the lava flow morphology corresponds to the rheology, which is basically the viscosity of the lava. And the rheology is really influenced by these two main things. One is the eruptive condition, it's just the magma flux is coming out, but it's also depending on the temperature. And the temperature has a lot of control in whatever is going on in the lava flow. It includes the density, and it also changes the crystallinity, and it has influence on the viscularity. So understanding this base of on connecting the base of these physical properties to the rheology and the morphology can actually help us to use this as an exploration tool, which is using the morphology to actually infer those properties. And on the left side of that same slide, number 13, there's a little graph from the 1980s, which shows that there are two specific lava flow morphology types that are usually found in basalts, which is one is called Pahorehoe and one is called A'a, and we'll show you nice videos of that just after that slide, so hold on a second. But that both, or these both surfaces are basically divided by a zone where things change in morphology. And this change in morphology corresponds to either a change in strain rate, so how fast you deform the material, or how fast it's actually flowing through a channel, for example, and the viscosity itself. And now that we know that the viscosity depends really on what's going on in the lava flow, et voila, we basically have our framework we can work with to understand what's happening in the lava and how we can exploit this mechanism. All right, so, and I hope for everyone, if you go to slide number 14, that this will work. On my YouTube channel, I've put up, I think, 4 or 5 videos that we're going to see in this talk. And what I'd like to do first is, for the ones that don't have not as good a sense as I do, maybe for the different types of lava flows, put up some videos in here. And the first one we're talking about is borehole. Usually that is something that is found close to the vent of a volcano. And there's a link underneath the image. If you click on that, it hopefully should direct you to my YouTube channel, and it shows that video. I'll just give everyone a second to just click on that and let it load. And while that's happening, I'll just explain what you can actually see in that one frame. You see black stuff, which is basalt, and you see red stuff. That's the hot lava that's underneath the crust kind of coming out. You see it's flat and shiny. It's not really a rough terrain in that sense. You'll see it later. It's a little bit different. In the front, you can see kind of wavy things. Those are pohoho ropes that form when a crust is moving. That is kind of still ductile, so it still deforms plastically. And then it cools. And underneath, there's still the hot lava. So let's have a look at how those things actually move. And if you click start, you can see these things just oozing out, just like honey or something like that. Looks like it's actually moving pretty fast. It can be even faster than that. We are quite far away from the vent, I would say about 10 miles or so. So it has already traveled a long distance, but it's coming out really flat. And if you just want to repeat this again, it's really short. You can really see how nicely it's flowing. And I've been there. I've been in the Big Island of Hawaii at Kilauea Volcano in 2012 and actually have sampled that stuff. So I stuck my hammer in it. It's really exciting, which is shown in that next video. So what I will basically do on slide number 15, and there's a link down there, I will crack open one of these lobes to actually sample the lava for, not just fun purposes, but also scientific research. So if you click on the link, I'll take my hammer, and I'll crack open the crust. And you can see the crust is still kind of plastic. And then I'll scoop my hammer in it, and it just drips off the hammer. It's really fluid lava that's still underneath. It's really hot. We're shielding our hands, or our faces with our hands. We're not really having any super protective gear because it was a really spontaneous trip at the USGS at the time when we had their conference in 2012. I'll just repeat it again. Crack it open and really have a look at what's inside. Just scoop it out with my hammer, and it will just drip and fall down. We pour water on it just to cool it down really quickly, because if we let it cool slowly, it will crystallize and it will change over time. So we don't want to have a real time look at the lava as it's being erupted. And just in case, are there any questions that I have been running over too fast? Please say so. If not,
we'll I just had a quick question, Alex, about
Sure.
You said you cool it really quickly because you wanted to what was that again?
I wasn't really elaborated nicely, but so we want to cool it off just to freeze it, to basically quench it. What we do is by pouring water on it, we cool it really, really fast. So whatever crystals are in there, they'd have no time at all to keep further crystallizing. And the reason why we're doing this and want to do this is to preserve the initial texture and crystal content and vesicularity that's happening right there at that spot in time. So if we cool it slower, it will keep crystallizing. So we have to basically freeze it and say, mm-hmm. You're not allowed to change anymore at all. So that's basically what we're doing.
Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm.
This is Kathy Lowry. how does the atmospheric conditions, you know, the amount of gravity, et cetera, affect the crystallization and the flow pattern?
So that's a good question. What will eventually happen if you have a lower gravity, you have less pressure? And I'll come back to that point a little bit later, too. So the lava flows might just be thicker, and it might be slow moving at a different pace because you're having less stress on the lava flow and therefore maybe a different strain rate. So that affects, and it will actually affect the lava flow morphology in the end, too. In terms of other atmospheric conditions, let's say a thicker atmosphere, like we would have it on Venus, you would have a much more efficient convective cooling because you have a denser material or atmosphere that's cooling off on the top of the lava flow. If you have something like on the moon where there's essentially no atmosphere, you would have a more radiative cooling. So cooling might be faster and slower, which will have an effect on the lava flow morphology as well. If that answers your question right away. Okay, I'll hear no follow-up. I assume that was satisfactory. Now let's skip ahead to slide number 16, which is now a different volcano, and I've been there in 2014 while I was a grad student at the University of Missouri. And we were lucky enough that we planned our field deployment in Guatemala, Pucayo volcano, which is shown on the right side image. You see the summit crater in the back. And a week before we actually went there, the volcano decided to erupt. So we're super lucky to actually witness a volcanic eruption there. I mean, they're really active volcanoes. First of all, they erupt every other year, but they actually being there, they're not really that long. They're maybe over a course of a week being actually there and watching it and sampling the rock again is fantastic to do the science. So what we're looking at is close to the lens. There's a little map on the left bottom where we see, let's call it the 1,500-meter line or elevation line, and it's cutting into that red lava flow that's kind of pictured in here. And you're standing right by that corner where it's number 4, 5, and 6. So standing up on that ledge, looking downwards onto the flow, really close to the vent. And there's another YouTube video, if you click on the link, hopefully it will show up. And it's farther from the distance. What you can see is lava flow in a channel running down on the flank. It looks different. It's not as shiny and flat anymore. It's actually moving quite fast. If you're more into looking at the left bottom of the video, you actually can see there's a darker streak right in the middle, which is the crust that's translated or moved onto the surface. And on the channel walls, it's actually redder. It's actually the hotter material you're exposed. It's moving relatively fast. I think we determined it, and it was about, I think, 3 meters per second or so. It was relatively fast. We actually have been down there in one of the corners. It was super hot. We couldn't stand there for a long time because we weren't prepared for it. But that's how lava flows when it's not really that hot anymore. It looks hotter because of the exposure of the camera. It's just adjusting to our lighting conditions. So it might look just as bright red as before, but it's actually not. It's cooled down quite a bit already, maybe 100 degrees less than that, which is maybe 1,100 in that case. But that's how it flows down on its channel close on midsection on lava flow volcano. And see if there was anything else to say. No. If we go to the next slide, hold on. I just want to repeat the little map on that same slide, number 16. The next slide will be at the terminus, which is basically the flow tail, which is the end where it's currently has migrated it the furthest. And it will look completely different from what we have seen before, which is called the RR lava. And let's go to slide number 17. And there's the next video up in here. Before I start the video, or you start the video, I'll just show what you can tell what you can see in that image in here. First of all, the lava flow, and you'll see running people in front of it, or grad students, and me too, is much higher. It's now several meters. It's not just maybe as high as my knee. The lava flow is much thicker. It's because it's more viscous in the end. It's colder, and it changes internally. And the migration form now is not that we have flat lobes that break open and then there's stuff oozing out. It's actually bits and pieces falling off this front and tumbling around to the bottom. And then once the lava flow is moving over, it gets picked up again and it's kind of moving like that. So the closest analogy I can come up with is kind of a snow plow truck that's just moving stuff. And then in the front, we'll see always things just tumbling around and get carried away and get picked up again and so on. If you'd like to start the video now, I'll just keep talking. So you can see that in here, there's pieces falling off mostly, but it still looks like there's the entire center is moving plastically. There's no about a larger chunk to fall off in my video. In here, it falls down and just tumbles around. Actually, I've been sampling it too, and it's me there. There's a piece that has just been falling off, and I was really, as a grad student, I was like, okay, this is just as easy as in Hawaii, which is about 2 years later. But it's not actually. It's not that oozy or fluid anymore. It's actually a solid piece of rock. You have to use your hammer and actually really whack it to break it open. It's a really tough job. It didn't look like it at all, because if you put a lot of pressure on it, it still moves kind of plastically, but it's in the end actually really solid rock. It needs a lot of force to actually deform it, and therefore will move. So it was a really long process, but what you can see in here is that we now have seen the full spectrum of lava flow morphologies, starting in Hawaii with something that is really smooth and flat and really fluid, to something that moves really slowly, is really hard, is really viscous, it breaks, and it looks different. It has a different surface texture. It's kind of rough. It's not smooth anymore. You actually can cut your hands on it if you don't wear any safety gloves. So if we move on to slide 18, and just one more word before that. So that transition can happen within the same lava flow. It doesn't need to, you always have pahora in one flow, and then you don't have an ah in the same flow. It happens if you cool to the right conditions, usually within the same flow. You can start out with lava flows that are right away because they're erupting at a much lower temperature. They're not always erupting at the same temperature. But if they're hot enough, they erupt as pahora and then they'll eventually change into ah. And it's somewhat summarized in the next slide, which is slide number 18, which is talking about the viscosity in most cases. And the viscosity really depends on the temperature of the lava flow. The cooler it is, the higher the temperature. You can kind of get that from cookie dough. If you take it out of the fridge, it's cold. So you actually can cut it nicely into chips or discs to make your cookies. But if it's warm, you actually can roll it and deform it nicely. So that's the same thing that happens in the lava flow too. The viscosity depends on the composition. Lava flows have different compositions. The solids change in the iron, magnesium, and sodium, potassium content, for example, and even more. But they also depend, the viscosity really largely depends on the crystal content and the bubble fraction in the lava. So, and as the lava will cool, they will eventually crystallize. And when they crystallize, of course, the crystal fraction will increase, but it will also change the residual liquid in composition. So it's a really complicating feedback relationship in here. So, but really, bottom line for that slide is, as lavas cool, they will change their flow behavior, which is expressed in lava flow morphology. If we're going to slide number 19, coming back to that one graph that I showed earlier from the 80s, it was basically a qualitative assessment and where pahora and aa happens. Based on the work that was done in Hawaii, we actually could quantify what kind of viscosity ranges this happens. Usually pahora less than 1,000 Pascal seconds. That's what viscosity is usually measured in. And then increase that by three orders of magnitude, and you will eventually have change the lava in our surfaces. Let's go to number 20, talking a little bit more about fluid dynamics in the engine here. Is a graph that is a little bit, has different units on the axis. The y-axis is now the pure shear stress, Pascal, and the x-axis is the strain rate. And we have different flow behaviors in here. So we have Newtonian fluids, which is a straight line. You can see them in here. And the slope on these lines is basically the viscosity, which is the strain rate and the stress. If you have a slower slope, you have low viscosities. If you have a higher slope on these graphs, you have high viscosities. So those are usually fluids that have no crystals or whatever in there. We can change that flow behavior from Newtonian to a non-Newtonian fluid, which in that case, in case of lava flow, we call it a pseudoplastic fluid. It's called, or translated into, shear thinning. What that is, it's not a straight line anymore. It's actually a curved line. And what that will tell you, if you're having low strain rates, you will have a higher slope on that curve, or you could put a tangent on it, and it will give you a higher slope. And that means that at low strain rates, you have higher viscosities. If you actually increase the strain rate, so going on that axis to the right on that dotted line, it will actually flatten out, and it will actually come a lower slope, and will have a lower viscosity, and that's the shear thing. So the faster you move, actually, within having the same crystal content, you can change the viscosity of it just by changing the shear stress conditions on here, which is a really important thing if you're looking at lava flow morphologies. And then the really special case later on is that red dotted line. It's called a Herschel-Bulkley fluid. It's basically the same thing as we talked earlier. It's a pseudoplastic fluid that has a yield strength. And the yield strength is basically a minimum force that you have to overcome to actually start deformation. And we'll give an all-day example on one of the next slides. Let me see. If you go to slide number 21, that's basically what I've just said. So I skipped ahead. So let's go to slide number 22, gives you an idea of what these fluids really could be. So Newtonian fluid is something like water and oil. It doesn't depend on the strain rate or the stress conditions, always having the same viscosities. The Bingham fluid would be your toothpaste if you squeeze it out of your toothpaste, little bottle or whatever. It will actually come out as a nice cylinder, and it won't deform unless you push a finger on it, and that's the yield strength, for example. You have to apply the extra force to actually start deforming it. And when you have pseudoplastic fluid, the closest you could have in your real all-day life is having ketchup. You remember, sometimes it does come out, you actually have to shake it, so you put some force on it, it actually becomes more fluid, and it comes out of the bottle. And that's what a pseudoplastic fluid really is. You're lowering the viscosity by applying some force to it. And to conclude about all the work in Hawaii, we go to slide number 23. That's what we have mapped out, the lava flow morphology changes. It starts close to the Manu'ulu vent. So all that orange in the map, it's Pahoehoe. And at some portion, it transitions. It's that green area, and then it turns into our determinant. Like at some point, about 4 to 5 kilometers, and then just being that really rough terrain that we have seen earlier in the video, and even on that little image on the bottom in the center panel, that's what that looks like. So if you go to slide number 25, based on the work in Hawaii, and it's coming out a little bit small in that little diagram, but we really could quantify that the morphology and the corresponds to physical properties. So actually, the first time it actually has been quantified, it has been always kind of a relative term, okay, higher viscosity or lower viscosity. But in that case, it was a really nice area to do that work, to say, okay, that changes in that kind of fraction of crystallinity and that kind of yield strength and all these parameters. over that kind of course of temperature. And there's another diagram which is, has those three color fields in here for the transition zone and the RR field, which is experimental work. And I'll talk that later on the demonstration of the Blue Dragon lava flow that I've been working on for finesse. But we can do those experiments in the lab to determine at what temperatures these viscosities happen for the real case in the lava flow. But anyway, we have quantified, and this is how the entire project for finesse, how I came up with it. It's like, okay, we have seen it. It's happening at specific values at Hawaii, which is on the right diagram, which is classification diagram for basalts, where the green star is for that particular composition. But we know that lava have different compositions, and therefore the crystallinity will be different at different temperatures. So, but also making the case that this transition from Pohoihoi to Au happens at specific values, you have a different natural laboratory to go to and do the same kind of work and look at this in the same way and find out, does that happen again? And if so, it's a true thing. So without further ado, I'll just go to slide number 26, and I'll take you out to the Blue Dragon lava flow up at Craters of Tune, a National Monument Preserve up in Idaho. And there's a couple of images on slide number 26. On the left side, you can see kind of the basin and range region, mostly of Nevada, and then there's a little red rectangle. Zooming in here, that's Craters of Tune. The entire lava flow field sitting in this eastern snake river plain. And if we zoom in a little bit more, we can see now different patches of gray. Can see things. And there's a little yellow dot in there. And that's basically that panoramic view that we're having on the bottom of that slide. Standing on spatter cones, which is the source of that Blue Dragon lava flow, that's spreading out to the left and to the right and covering the entire area. Okay, so if you go to slide number 27, that's actually the last video for today, and it will show you a nice overview going along the entire flow, giving you some imagery we have collected with a unmanned aerial vehicle, UAV imagery. Instead of satellite images, and so we're getting a really high resolution look at it. So if you click at the link, it will show up basically Google Earth first, and we'll zoom into our area, created the moon, and we'll start out at the visitor center, and then the video will follow going down a bit south, and we'll see the spatter cones with the parking lot. And then if we go further south, we see more spatter cones. That's kind of the high point sticking out. And then we're coming into an area that looks a little bit more yellow. That's our own imagery. There's large holes, big collapses of lava tubes. And that's the Blue Dragon lava flow coming up now. Is you can see lots of lobes. They're kind of bright patches. They almost look as shiny as in Hawaii. And at some point, we go further downflow, we see nice channel walls developing, and those brighter patches will disappear, get less and less and less more visible, and actually the terrain will change into that already will look to your eyes really rough to walk on. You can see lots of high points. You can see the pressure ridges, which are kind of like a wavy feature it will see with your eye on the lava flow. And the further downflow we go, it'll become even more prominent. And depending where you're at in the video, we'll stop out at the flow terminus in there. So what you have seen in that video is the transition happening again in a different lava flow of different compositions erupted at Craters of the Moon. And basically we're going there to find out why is it happening again and does it happen in the same manner as in Hawaii. And if we go on to slide number 28, we see one of the first images where that big holes were, and we have Derek Sears as scale. You can see it's a flat surface. There's lobes. We have the big hole and just behind Derek Sears. And kind of on the horizon, you see that little higher point sticking out. That's one of the spatter cones up in here. If we go further south or further down flow, let's say about maybe 300 meters from the point we have just looked at, you can actually see it standing on a higher point on one of the levees. You can see in the middle, it says on the top direction of flow going east. You can see in the middle there's a brighter patch, which is that kind of lobe feature that we've seen in the Hawaii video. It's nicely flat. And it's a little bit more detailed in the next slide, on slide number 30. You can see it just looks the same way. I have to tell you that the lava flow here is much, much older. It's about 2,000 years old, so there's some erosion and weathering and deposition of anything that's transported either by water or wind a little bit on here. So it's not as the prime example as in Hawaii, but you can see still flat, shiny surfaces and lobes up in here. If we go even further downflow, you can see now this completely changed. It's not as nice anymore, and it resembles more that texture we've seen in Pacaya in Guatemala, that lava flow, where it's blocky, it's rough terrain, and it's really not nice to walk on. You can break your legs easily if you just step on the wrong piece of rock, and it's just sitting on there loosely. It's just really dangerous to walk on. But it's also much higher in relief, so the surface roughness overall will change. You can easily hide behind one of the larger blocks. People can't find you anymore. If you go further in the distance and we see 100 meters or yards, you might be covered up until your hip, whereas on a Pohoro flow, maybe your ankles or knees are covered. So there's much more relief in further downflow as you go, as the lava flows down in its channel. If you go on slide number 32, just from our field deployment that was just happening a month ago. Further upflow, again, there's lots of large craft, and it's a separate study we're going to expand this work on. It's really the anatomy of the Blue Dragon. So the flow is called Blue Dragon flow. What we're really doing is we're taking the entire flow apart in the sense of mapping it out nicely. We're taking samples from every kind of surface, from the channel walls to the interior and even into the depth. So that's what we're doing up in here. We're actually getting depth profiles of changes in physical properties by Jeff Collin, one of the teachers up in Idaho, crawling or actually volunteering to crawl into that crack. We have him secure with ropes and get him out eventually again to get those pieces out there, which is a fantastic scenario to study. Changes not just with flow distance, but even with depth within the same flow. If we go to slide number 33, we're actually having those visible images or photographs that we've seen in that video taken, and those are usually stereo pairs. We can create digital terrain models, DTMs, in a really, really high resolution. And in that case, it is 5 centimeters per pixel, so we can actually have a 3D model of the lava flow and really correlate and do all kinds of statistics on the surface flow morphology on the computer rather than the field. And to give you an overview of what we have done, the entire flow is about 2.75 kilometers long. If you follow the entire center line, you can see a lot of yellow stars on here. That's where we have sampled over the 2016 deployment, and we have added about 8 more samples this year, totaling up to 35 samples within the lava flow. So it is a really detailed study that's coming out of the Finesse project up in here. We're really systematically looking at the changes in the lava flow properties. If you go to slide number 34, there's actually examples of these rocks. Just picked out not all of them because it's a lot, but you can see actually in the little hand sample that they were kind of flat. The first one is right at the spatter cones. It's called a lava bomb. It's kind of looking chaotic. It's really light. It's really vesicular. And the next one, a little bit further down below, it's a piece of the lobe. It's kind of rounded in surface. And a little bit further downflow, it's the same thing, it's kind of flat surface. And at some point, sample number 10, I will start out at these textures that look kind of jagged, rough, spiny, that are not the typical Polaroid anymore. So we collected real samples and feel that show actually the transition even on the skin of the rocks itself. And it will change throughout the entire length of the lava flow up to the last sample. Okay, now let's have a more zoomed in look at these rocks and give you an idea of what's happening on a macroscopic scale. So taking all of these samples now and looking at them at the scanning electron microscope, and what we see is that they start out being really vesicular at the beginning, and there's not a lot of crystals in there. Their bubbles are rounded, low crystallinity. If you go to slide number 36, which you see in the black and white SEM images, later on the crystallinity will increase, the bubble sizes change, and the shapes even change too. We really run down quickly because there's a summary slide coming up too. 37, further down flow, we can actually see that. That looks crystalline. There's those little gray and white speckles in the gray images. They appear to be more and more. Further down flow, 38, contrast not really working out nicely on that slide. But if you go and further down until slide number 42, it's basically summarized in a more zoomed in look. It will actually give you the changes in one slide, and you can see those crystals coming in more and more further down flow we go, and that's really controlling the viscosity and therefore the flow morphology in here. It's on the next slide, 43 is actually summarized in terms of graphs, and we have the first graph, it's distance versus crystal fraction, and you can see it's not really changing much within the first kilometers, and then in that gray field that we mapped out as the morphological transition zone, you actually can see the increase in crystallinity in here. And we have two more plots on the right on the same slide, number 43, that's showing the bulk density with distance and the pore volume fraction. You can see the increase in bulk density increases up until the transition zone, and it kind of becomes flat in that red dotted line. It's not a fitting line per se. So you can see it's kind of flattening out within the transition zone and doesn't go higher afterwards. And the pore volume fraction will decrease with increasing distance. So what's happening in that lava flow is that the tumbler around all these lava getting reworked and basically squeezing out any bubbles of the lava, so it becomes actually more and more dense. What's also happening is that while there are less bubbles in the lava itself, they each actually closing up. They're not connected anymore, so there's no coherent pathway through bubbles that you could connect from the surface into the interior of the rock itself. So they're actually becoming really isolated, and that's a way to measure that too. So we can actually really track down the changes in those properties. If you go to slide number 44, and I'm hoping I'm running that too quickly for this, but I've got to track up the time. We can see actually we're doing some preliminary statistics with the DTMs. It's really important that we have those DTMs because we can now looking at the morphology and changes in roughness, and that's really what we want to determine later on in the exploration tool. We can do up in this here on the plot on the right side is elevation versus flow distance. And what you can see is for the downflow and the increasing flow distance, that line becomes thicker, black line becomes much thicker. It's not because I manipulated this somehow, it's because the roughness changes, so you have much more belief in the lava flow, which makes in that plot that line thicker. So you can actually determine later on the changes in height from one point to the other, and we'll see that this increases, and we'll have that shown in one of the slides that's coming up. If you're going to slide number 45, this is a more detailed view up in here, giving you a little bit more context about the flow morphologies or surface textures that we've looked at before. Close to the vent, first one is where the smooth patches disappear. We have polar ropes. It looks kind of flat, and then you go into sort of the transition zone. It's becoming more rougher, and then within the transition zone, and essentially you're coming to the flow end, and you actually can see there's like the line become really wavy. It's really high point, low point. It's really, really rough terrain. So the flow roughness increases downflow. And it's summarized in one of the slides, numbers 46, which is flow resistance against the RMS height, which is basically the root mean square height. It's basically the difference between one point to the other. And you can see it's been in 50 meters intervals as a first look based on the center line itself, just one center line throughout the lava flow from vent to toe. You can see that with increasing distance, you can actually mathematically quantify the surface roughness increase overall. And now that you have basically determined the flow distance and the roughness values and flow distance and the physical properties, you can now combine these two things into getting a mathematical representation of the surface roughness and correlate these to the physical properties, which is on slide number 47. In that case, we have done it for the bulk density, which is basically the larger plot is a combination of the two on the right side. But you can see the surface roughness is a really simple way to look at this, and there's more sophisticated ways, and I'm talking about this in the next slide. But what you can see is there's a trend, there's a correlation between however you want to fit it. You can fit it with the blue line, be giving R squared correlation coefficient. There's a correlation. If you want to give it a more curved line, it's even a better correlation. But the real case, well, there will be some increase in bulk density, and at some point it will level out because there's a maximum density a lava flow can have. So it's the way you want to represent it. But anyway, with that one, we actually could prove that we can classify the physical properties based on a mathematical representation, in that case, surface roughness. But it's a really simple way, and our colleagues at Idaho State University, which is a grad student, Hester Maloney, and the professor Shannon Kozniewodniak in Pocatello, they're actually looking at this much more sophisticated, and they are about to having this finished out. And what they're doing is doing the same kind of thing using UAV imagery and doing that RMS height. But they're also doing surface ratio. It's basically a 2D over a 3D ratio. And then you can, on different resolutions, you can actually see different roughness values in the end. So they're currently working on this. And whenever they're getting to that point where they're having it done, they'll run that code over the flow that I was just showing you and actually apply our findings to that method in here. All right, now there's a little break, and it's the last part of that talk. Usually I called that talk in the earlier versions inferred thermal physical properties, because as a volcanologist, you would be actually super excited if you could look at the flow morphology and already can predict the temperature. Usually how a volcanologist would do it, it would get a real rock sample, take it in the laboratory, and measure chemical compositions and so on to determine what eruption temperature it was. But if you're looking at something like a mercury on the moon, you can just go there and pick a rock up. So how nice would it be to actually infer eruption temperature and giving you a sense of the mathematic history of that particular era and possibly explain something about the thermal evolution of that region and the body itself? Well, there's a way to do this by morphology, and it's going back into the laboratory where you can measure the viscosity. And the main method in here is doing this at high magmatic temperatures between 16 to 1150 or 1100 degrees. It's the lower viscosity range. It's called a concentric cylinder apparatus, where you basically have a cup of platinum where you melt your rock in there and you stick a spindle in it and you rotate it at a constant rate, and it measures the torque that it needs to be at that spinning rate. And therefore, over the mathematical descriptions, you can get viscosity values out of here. And if you go on slide number 51, there's a usual a plot that we would do, volcanologists would do, maybe. But what it has is you observe viscosity on a log scale on the y-axis and an inverse on the x-axis. And for reference, I give a centigrade scale on the top. and give you more sense of what the viscosities of these lava flows actually are. And they're coming out there like honey, and their viscosity increases up to maybe sour cream or even up to peanut butter in Pohari cases. So if you go to slide 52, there's a lot of things going on in here, which is basically all kinds of melt viscosities for all kinds of planetary surfaces that are measured over the course of the last 7 years. But there's also plotted the lava for Blue Dragon. And what we can see is that it will start crystallizing somewhere around 1250 degrees is where those star symbols coming in. And that is really driving up the viscosity, and it's plotted in these stars up in here. It's really deviating from that red fitting line where there would be no crystals. It's just a temperature effect on the melt itself. But as soon as you add the crystals, the viscosity will increase several orders of magnitude. And it is summarized in slide number 53. There you have, that's basically the same plot we've seen from the 80s early on, where we have viscosity on the X and strain rate on the Y. We can collect all these points at different strain rates in the laboratory, and we can predict, because we have earlier quantified it, what viscosity and strain rate ranges these Pohari and RO fields should be. We can plot these data up in here at those specific temperatures, and we can infer at what temperature that morphology would change for that particular lava flow and its composition. And it will almost be done in here is slide 54. So what you could do with these laboratory experiments is really label that lava flow field based on morphology, saying, okay, close to the vent, it looks like it has been at 1,250 degrees and above. And then it's transitioning somewhere at 1,200 degrees Celsius, and then it turns into RR somewhere at temperatures below 1,150 degrees Celsius. So that's what you can do and to infer the thermal properties of the lava flow based on remote sensing in some laboratory work. And the last slide, 55, is concluding take-home messages. Just summarizing really quickly, hopefully I could convince you that the lava flow morphology really depends on what's happening in the lava flow itself. And we have a repeating pattern, and it's happening at the same order of magnitude in these physical properties as we've seen it in Hawaii. Therefore, it's a real thing, and it should apply to any type of lava flow, whether it's on Earth or it's on somewhere else in the solar system. So we can do that work to actually estimate or infer those thermal physical properties of the lava flows. And I'm sorry I'm a little bit long over time, but I'm happy to answer all your questions now.
Great. Thanks, Alex. While people are unmuting, I have a couple questions of myself. First of all, I love all the food analogies. That actually really helps me.
Yeah, right. It's something you need.
Yeah. And I just got to say that I've never really had such a concise explanation between the difference between pohoihoi and a'a. I really love the videos as well, so thank you for those.
Oh, it's great to hear.
I also had a question about, you were saying how we can't go and get samples for these places, but we do have lunar samples. How much have you kind of correlated your results with the existing lunar samples that we have?
So basically none of them yet. So whatever I do is just basically trying to find out the fundamental dynamics or kinetics that's happening on the flow. So at some point, what you would need is really to have a flow surface imaged in a DTM, as we have shown it in here, to get an idea of the mathematical description of the surface roughness, to get an idea of where that corresponds within the flow. The way it really works is looking at the morphology first and then infer the crystallinity itself. So if I would have a look at the rock from the moon, and actually the people, lunar scientists do this, they're looking at the rock and can tell you everything about it, and the eruption temperature and the crystallinity and so on. So they're already a step ahead, so they don't need me in that part essentially anymore. So they can already do all that work based on the sample they have. And this work really targets, and if we can't go there, then this will be really a helpful tool.
Great, thanks. And just so that I'm clear, is there a difference between DTMs and DEMs?
Oh, no, it's the same thing. It's digital elevation model. People always change it up. I sometimes change it within the same presentation, but it's the same thing.
Okay, just want to make sure.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Let's see, is Andrea on the line? Did she want to say anything about International Tour of the Moon Night?
Hi, yes, I'm here. I just wanted to thank you again, Alex, for that great talk. And, yes, remind everyone that International Observer Moon Night is on October 28th this year, and I encourage all of you to go out and look at the moon and talk with your friends and neighbors and communities about it. And we are launching a new website for this event very soon, so look for that with a NASA.gov address coming soon.
I have a quick question from slide number 9, if I can ask it.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
In looking at those pictures, you've got those listed as lava flows on Mercury.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious, how do you tell the difference between the termination of a lava flow and maybe a wrinkle ridge or linear scarp like on Mercury or the Moon?
So, yeah, wrinkle ridge, I guess it's some sort of... So wrinkle ridge could be a volcanic feature. So lava smoke flowing. A linear feature is a tectonic feature. Like we have compression on Mercury going on. So and there's those scarps as well. They especially if you're looking at maybe the frame E. If you're looking at the flow fronts, there's people actually looking at the fractals, like how wavy they are. In that case, you could do that kind of work. You're looking at how much they deviate from being just a straight line and actually having a wavy outcrop or flow front. That's the way you could do this, I guess.
And then I just had one final question about your video 2A at Pacaya.
Mm-hmm.
There seems to be a dark stripe like right in the middle of the river. Is that place just cooler than the outsides or...
Yes, that's what it is. That's a really good observation. So what's happening is as you get closer to sometimes to the edges, or it really depends on what the geometry of the lava chain on itself is, there are less disturbances in the middle. It's more of a linear flow, most likely. So whatever crust is actually sitting on the top, it's in that case, it's crust that's just sitting there. It's cooler. And... On the edges or on the walls, you have some more turbulence that's going on where there's a little bit more overturn or disruption of the crust because it gets jammed and locked onto the side wall and it kind of tears apart and then it exposes the hotter lava on the bottom. So in the end, yes, it's a temperature gradient on the surface. If you could say it's that way, in the middle, it's a little bit cooler probably because of the crust. It's just sitting there stationary, getting transported downflow. And on the edges, you have the hotter interior exposed.
Oh, that's so interesting, because I would have, if you had asked me before, I would have guessed the other way around. But yeah, it makes sense when you
say
something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, I know we're at the top of the hour, but I do want to remind people that, you know, you're always welcome to email us questions, and we'll get them to Alex if you have questions later. And I know some people prefer PowerPoint, and if you need help getting any of the images out to make your own PowerPoint, just let us know and we can help you with that. So thank you to everyone for joining us today, and thank you to Alex for a wonderful presentation. Alex, any last words for people?
If you have any questions, please feel free to shoot me an email. I'm happy to answer this. The videos will be on the YouTube channel, so you can always leave a comment right there if you have one, or just get in contact some other way, and I'm happy to answer all your questions.
Yeah. Again, my name is Jeff Nee, and my email address is jnee@jpl.nasa.gov. The next Museum Alliance telecon is on Thursday, September 14th, and it's about weight watching from space, all about the GRACE follow-on missions. So information, as always, is on our websites, and we hope to hear you there. Thank you again to Alex and to Andrea for putting this together. It was a lot of fun.